Court is ready to hear argument in 050832, Lamar Homes, Inc. v. Mid-Continent Casualty Company.
May it please the Court, Mr. Lee Shiklowski will present argument for the appellate. The appellate has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, opposing counsel, there are three certified questions before the Court today. The first two deal with the definition of property damage and occurrence in a CGL policy, and the third deals with Article 2155 of the Texas Insurance Code. Because the third certified question is conditioned on affirmative answers on the first two, and because the first two are really at the heart of the debate, I plan on, unless the Court has any questions, relying on the briefing for the 2155 questions, and I would call the Court's attention to an amicus brief that was just filed on Friday by Valero Energy and Erickson that specifically addresses Article 2155 and its applicability to liability policies. Turning now to the first two questions. The Fifth Circuit asks, when a home buyer sues his general contractor for construction defects and alleges only damage to or loss of use of the home itself, do such allegations allege an accident or occurrence sufficient to trigger a duty to defend or duty to indemnify? And the second question is similar. Do those same allegations allege property damage sufficient to trigger the duty to defend or indemnify? Lamar Homes contends that the answers to those two questions, based on the policy language, is yes.
What do you think the accident was, specifically?
The accident is the unexpected and unintended damage that results from the faulty workmanship. It's not the faulty workmanship itself. It's the unexpected and unintended consequences from the faulty workmanship that's the accident.
But so, the coverage is for, damages resulting from an occurrence. Is that right or not?
It's physical injury that results from an occurrence.
And so the physical injury is the faulty workmanship or not?
No, the physical injury is the result of the faulty workmanship. If it's just a defect itself, if you just put windows in backwards in a house, that's not property damage. That's just a defect. If the windows then leak and cause water damage, that's the unexpected and unintended result. That's the physical injury that results from the defective workmanship.
So if it's a bad paint job or a poorly hung door,
No coverage. And Lamar is not contending that. Pure customer dissatisfaction claims are not covered under a CGL policy. It's because they're not property damage. If the specs call to paint a house red and you paint it white, or hopefully that would probably be the other way around, the mere fact that the paint color is wrong is not physical injury to tangible property. That's not the sort of thing a CGL policy is designed.
But it was, are you saying then that it was your client's intent when it got a CGL policy that if you built a house with a slab that was poorly designed or poorly made and it broke, it was your intent that somebody else would pay to fix that?
If the work arose out of the work of subcontractors and it caused physical damage, yes, it was. That is exactly the intent of purchasing a CGL policy, to provide protection for unintended and unexpected consequences. And in this particular
case, it has to be a pretty unimaginative plaintiff attorney that can't imagine some harm besides painting. I mean, people don't file lawsuits because you painted the house the wrong color. They file them because you did something wrong that made the foundations don't do this and the doors don't do that. So, in effect, it is the CGL is going to cover virtually every home defect suit that's filed.
Well, there's a difference between the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify. If you do have an imaginative plaintiff and he does plead physical damage, arising
from They always do.
Then there's a duty to defend. But the duty to indemnify is based on the actual facts. If that plaintiff can't prove up that physical injury to tangible property, then there's going to be no duty to indemnify.
Is there a scenario where the subcontractor is required to provide its own coverage or be bonded for situations like this?
Typically, the subcontractor does, or hopefully the subcontractor does have its own insurance. And in most of these cases, the subcontractors are a party to the litigation.
And so in a situation like this, if you're correct, then that wouldn't be necessary in the future, would it?
I'm sorry?
Those bonding requirements wouldn't be necessary in the future. If you can always claim against the sub that there's essentially coverage for all types of occurrences under CGL.
Well, I said that the subcontractor typically has has insurance, the bonding issue and the whole argument that Mid-Continent makes that this is not a performance bond, and it's just the simple reality is that performance bonds are just not used in residential construction. They are in commercial construction, and the implications of this case and what this court decides certainly extend well beyond residential construction. But in the home construction arena, performance bonds are just not used. It's not part of the project. Mid-Continent's entire no coverage.
Let me ask you a question, taking off on Justice Green's question. If the foundation is not built properly and a 2-inch crack develops in it, but it causes no other damage to the building, there's no leaking, just hypothesize that may be unlikely, then there's no accident or occurrence here.
Well, you know, that's interesting. You highlight what is an emergency because you
went to great pains to distinguish between doing something wrong in building versus doing something wrong that causes other injury.
Right. I believe that the crack itself, that is physical injury to tangible property. Now, there is an emerging middle ground, and you just highlighted what that is, and I don't particularly endorse this middle ground because I still think you have to read something into the policy, into the property damage definition and the occurrence that's not there. But if you were to go with that middle ground, it would still require affirmative answers. And the middle ground is exemplified just recently by the Okadi Hotel Group case, and that's at 2006 Westlaw 91577. It's a brand new case out of the District Court in South Carolina. What that court said, it looked at the LJ case from the South Carolina Supreme Court, which said no occurrence if it's just damage to the work itself. And it looked at the case that LJ relied on, which is the High Country case out of New Hampshire, which said damage to the work itself could be an occurrence. And it tried to reconcile the two. And what it said was, and again, this is the new middle ground approach, if the physical damage is just to the defective work itself. In other words, in your example, Justice Wainwright, if the faulty workmanship is to the foundation and all that is physically injured is the foundation, then there's no occurrence of property damage. But if the faulty foundation causes structural damage beyond the foundation itself, even though that still all the general contractor's work is defined by the policy, that is an occurrence of property damage. In Okadi, you had a hotel. And there was problems with the exterior, I believe the windows and the exterior sheathing. And the court said, if that's all, if the exterior sheathing started to crack, under LJ, that wouldn't be an occurrence of property damage. But once water got in and damaged other parts of that hotel, even though it's all the general contractor's work, that is an occurrence of property damage. And again, even if the court were to buy into that middle ground position, it requires affirmative answers to the two certified questions. Mid-Continent's entire no coverage position, their entire briefing here is premised on the faulty premise that a CGL policy per se does not cover claims sounding in contract or warranty. In particular, Mid-Continent argues that damages sought by homeowners against their general contractors are presumed to be expected or intended by virtue of the inherent contractual promise that you provide a properly constructed home. The problem with that argument is nothing in the definition of property damage or occurrence says anything about breach of contract or breach of warranty.
And well, you just don't think of a breach of contract as an accident. That's one thing.
Well,
it's just not, you think of an accident as somebody hitting somebody out on the street and not somebody failing to perform under promised agreement.
Well, this court has routinely recognized that the contractual relationship between the parties can create duties under both a contract and a tort, and that the same act may breach the contract and the tort either simultaneously or individually.
Well, but apart from contract and tort, again, you just don't think of it's just hard to think of a breach of contract as an accident.
Well, you've got
something
keep,
people do more intentionally.
You got to keep in mind here that under the particular facts of this case and really the facts of most of the cases that were in the appendix in this context, the general contractor is not alleged to have performed the work itself. The general contractor is alleged to have negligently supervised its subcontractors. They're the ones that perform the work. And so it is a breach of contract cause of action only because it's Lamar Holmes, the general contractor, that has the contract with the homeowner. But there's not a real big difference between a negligence claim against them and a breach of contract claim. Now, it's true that the negligence claim may not be viable because of the economic loss rule. That's exactly Mid-Continent's argument. Well, you can't sue in negligence because of the economic loss rule. But there are several problems with that argument. The economic loss rule is a liability defense. Jim Walter Homes, Mobility Homes, all those cases have nothing to do with insurance coverage, let alone with the specific definitions of property damage and occurrence.
Coming back to occurrence, though, tell me where in this sequence the accident occurs. The homeowner says, there's water all over my house, and how did it get there? Well, I hired a foundation contractor. He poured the concrete wrong. It cracked. That caused the walls to shift and the water came in. It was an accident. That's not an accident. He never should have built the foundation the way he did. And if you let him, that's your problem. It's hard to say that's an accident.
Well, the accident is not just the cause or the effect. It's the culmination of the cause and the effect. So the building of the faulty...
The culmination of...
In other words, it's not just the cause. It's not just the act of building, and it's when that act results in unexpected or unintended property.
But in a commercial case, the culmination may be in fact intended. In a breach of contract case, you may the one contracting party may certainly intend the culmination to be faulty construction and damage, but he thinks economically that's easier for him to buy than spending the money to supervise properly, as you would say. So it's not necessarily an accident. It's not necessarily in the commercial context unintended.
Well, and Lamar Holmes is not contending that every allegation of negligence or breach of contract or breach of warranty is going to be an accident. What Lamar Holmes is contending is that you just can't set a bright line rule that if the allegations are to damage the home itself, that per se cannot be property damage or an occurrence.
The problem I have is I don't discern any rule. If there's not a bright line rule, then what is the rule? And it's just hard to see where you think of an accident as a tree falling over on something when it shouldn't have. But not that walls leak because somebody built a bad foundation.
Well, you know, the one thing that's interesting, if you look at the facts of this case, and I understand the court is not deciding the facts of this case, but in addition to insuring Lamar Homes, Mid-Continent insured the foundation subcontractor, and yet they took an exactly opposite position vis-a-vis Hilburn. They said, as to Hilburn, the subcontractor that allegedly constructed the foundation, it's property damage to an occurrence. But as to the general contractor, Lamar, it's not. It just simply does not make sense that the same cracks in the sheetrock and the stone veneer can be property damage caused by an occurrence as to the foundation subcontractor, but not as to the general contractor. The mere existence of a contract between Lamar Homes and the Damaris doesn't support that conclusion, and no possible justification in the underwriting or otherwise supports that distinction.
Do we have to worry about the fact that if we were to adopt a rule like what you're talking about, that the contractors would essentially be encouraged is not the right word, but wouldn't be so concerned about following their contractual responsibilities because they always can call upon their CGL carrier to cover any mistakes?
I don't think so at all, Your Honor. Professionals such as lawyers and doctors have insurance coverage to cover the results of our shoddy workmanship, and although my client may disagree, there hasn't seemed to be a lapse of attentiveness on the part of doctors and lawyers just because we have. I don't let a statute of limitations go by and say, my malpractice carrier will take care of it. And the truth is everyone knows in this room who's been in an auto accident that may have been your fault or has gotten a speeding ticket, you get a little gift at renewal time in the form of an increased premium. And if you get two speeding tickets, or if you get in two accidents, you get a substantial increase in premium, or you get canceled altogether. So the point is that sort of risk is taken care of through the underwriting process.
What is the ISO CG 2294 that you refer to?
ISO CG 2294 is a new endorsement that came in, I believe, in 2003, and it eliminates the subcontractor exception. And the subcontractor exception to exclusion L is what we pointed, not to create coverage, but just to show the fallacy of Mid-Continent's position.
But you say in your brief, if that endorsement had been for this policy, then there would be no coverage whatever.
That is absolutely correct.
And so is this being done or across the country? Or?
Mid-Continent will not issue a policy in the state of Texas, to my knowledge, that does not have CG 2294 on it today.
Any further questions?
Because if it wasn't in there at the time, there is coverage.
I'm sorry.
And because it wasn't in there at the time, there is coverage.
That's exactly what we contend is they're trying to retroactively insert it.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the appellee.
May it please the court, Jennifer Hogan will present argument for the appellee.
Ms. Hogan, can you address that last statement made here by opposing counsel?
Pardon me?
Can you address the last statement made by opposing counsel, please?
The ISO?
Yes.
Endorsement?
And that you're trying to retroactively exclude coverage.
Certainly, we're not trying to retroactively exclude coverage. We believe that that it's not an exclusion that has anything to do with this case at all, with the insurance provisions of the policy. I think that if we look at the intent of the parties, the argument that has been put forward was that it is this change in the policy language that occurred in 1988, which added this exception to an exclusion, and that exception to an exclusion that came into practice in 1988 suddenly made construction defects claims, as long as the construction defects were performed by subcontractors, suddenly now liability insurance covered all of that because of this change in the policy language in 1988. No court held that in 1988. No court really ever held that until about the year 1999 and starting into the 2000s and now, and a few courts have accepted this argument that's being brought forward by the other side, that somehow this exception to an exclusion created coverage that had never existed before for construction deficiencies. When that started happening, 10 to 15 years after the fact, the ISO came back and drafted a new endorsement that takes out not just the exception, right? It's going to take out the entirety of ever being able to get coverage for any sort of true property damage caused by an accident to the insured's work, even if it happens by subcontractors. All I think that demonstrates is that the intent of the parties was never in adding that exception to the exclusion to, in fact, create this coverage. Once it started that a court accepted that interpretation of the policy, the ISO came back and said, no, that's not ever been the intent of the parties, and we're going to, if that is what's triggering this analysis by the courts, this exception to the exclusion, we are in fact going to take it out. So I think that it may well be true. I don't know. It's not in the record whether Mid-Continent is including that in its policies now or not. But it would certainly, I would suggest that if with the split in the authority that exists in the courts underlying this court today in Texas, I would say it certainly is a prudent thing for it to do, not because I think that the policy actually covers those things as it exists today, but simply to make certain that if a court is going to undertake that interpretation of the policy, then the insurance carrier is going to be protected. Because if you look at what this policy does cover, it's a standard form policy for commercial general liability. The premium in this case, the total premium for all aspects of the coverage, including its premises operations and vacant property, the entire premium for that property for this coverage was $12,005. It covers every bodily injury that someone's going to sustain, basically, from an accidental standpoint. If someone is trespassing on a vacant lot and gets himself injured, and the home builder, because he owns the property, is sued, that's going to be a covered occurrence. If somebody trips and falls from a roof when a house is under construction, if somebody drops a board or a piece of lumber on the child next door or the trike next door or the fence next door, or something lands on the owner's car when he drives through, somebody shoots a nail gun, all of those kinds of accidents cause property damage and bodily injury, and every one of those is covered under this policy. Construction sites are dangerous places. We want people to have liability policies. We want people to pay $12,005 a year so that if someone gets badly injured on a particular site, we have all of these people who paid that kind of money in, then it's going to be covered. Those are the kinds of fortuitous risks that everyone agrees that this policy covers. But that's what Lamar Holmes paid $12,005 for.
So what do you think the exception to exclusion one covers?
I think we set out a couple of things that it covers in our brief, Your Honor. It covers, for example, you could have, there can be accidents that damage the work of the contractor. And his work is obviously the entire structure. And to put it into this sort of completed operations when the home is finished, we say if someone goes out to perform a warranty, say the dishwasher isn't working, someone goes out, performs that warranty, and leaves, and on the way out, tosses a match. The house burns down. That's damage to your work. It's damage to your work by an accident. That's the same kind of risk that exists if a stranger is walking by the house, flicks a match over, and burns down the house.
But you say if it was the insured's employee, it wouldn't be covered?
That's right. That's what we said.
But if it's the insured's
subcontractor
employee,
it would be covered.
Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
I think you can maybe look at most of these things. They're going to, one perhaps that makes more sense, this subcontractor exception is there to cover the idea that you have more subcontractors doing work, but it's accidents
like
that it's going
both.
To cover.
I mean, surely if you wanted one, you'd want both.
You might want both, but the subcontractor exception is a step to give back some coverage that would otherwise be excluded, but only for accidents. Contractors are all the time constructing more than a single project in, say, a subdivision or in a townhome complex. If one is finished and you back a truck or a backhoe into the one that's completed next door, if you're the subcontractor, that's going to be an accident. It's unintentional damage. It doesn't have anything to do with the actual work that you were then, the operations that you were then providing to the other home. That's the same thing as if anyone drove a car into your house, into your completed structure. That would be an accident. That would be covered under the policy. We have to be able to give, under this court's precedence, some meaning to the exclusion. The exclusions are narrow because they're, in the first instance, frankly, there is not a lot of accidents causing damage to your work that are going to exist because those are simply not accidents. I mean, Justice Heck, you were correct to try and point out, ask, where is this accident? What is this accident? And I don't think it can actually ever be identified to the court. The suggestion that...
But it seems to me there have to be some kinds of things that are accidents or you wouldn't have exclusion one.
Certainly, and there are. If a tree falls on the house while it's under operations... That's going to be an accident causing property damage to your work. We then are going to reach the exclusions. Some of them may apply, they may not. But there certainly can be accidents to your work. If you send someone to come in doing warranty work again, it's completed operations. If he trips and falls through a plate glass window when he was coming to repair the dishwasher, someone's coming to repair the dishwasher, that's going to be an accident causing damage to your work. That is not, however, a claim for defective construction. And if we take this court, the way this court has always looked at these kinds of questions, the way it looked at Griffin, the way it looked at the Cowan case, Griffin is the case of the drive-by shooting, Cowan is the case with the suggestive pictures, and but we're just asking that you apply the identical type of analysis to this case that you applied in those cases. In those cases, you said, there are pleadings of negligence. There's an allegation that he failed to maintain a safe speed or failed to operate his vehicle in a safe manner. The court looked at those and it applied the overarching law that exists that distinguishes between negligence claims and intentional tort claims. And this court said, it's an intentional tort claim. The label that the plaintiff attaches doesn't matter. It's an intentional tort claim. And the damages that flow from an intentional tort are not accidental damages. Identically in this case, what we ask the court to do is apply that same analysis. They have pleaded negligence.
Well, let's go back a minute. You said damages that flow from an intentional tort are not accidental damages. There can be unintended or unexpected consequences of intentional acts, can't they? Or did you mean to say that damages that flow from intentional conduct are not occurrences?
No, I mean to say, Your Honor, that in the intentional tort realm, it doesn't matter whether you subjectively intended your consequences. The court is able to distinguish. There are certainly intentional acts cases. You may have an intentional act that's only a negligence claim. But when you're talking about an intentional tort, this court, in fact, I mean, that's what the court wrote in Griffin. It doesn't matter that you didn't expect the damage, that you didn't know that she was going to see the pictures, that you didn't know that she was going to be harmed by your acts. Your intentional conduct, you are charged with those damages as a matter of law, and your subjective intent does not matter. And it's identical in the contract situation, Your Honor. These damages, the law says that these direct damages, the loss to the structure itself, to the subject of your contract, that damage is conclusively presumed foreseeable. That's just contract law. And that contract law is no different, really, than the intentional tort law that says these damages from your intentional tort, if I hit you, the fact that you then die and I say, wow, I didn't intend that, is not going to protect you in the intentional tort analysis.
I'm concerned that the intentional tort that you're throwing extends too far. The allegations here, at least part of them, are that there was negligent workmanship, that in performing the contract, some of the work was done negligently or shoddily. Are you saying that's intentional?
No, I don't think this is an intentional tort case.
But it was negligent work that caused the problem, that breached the contract here, right?
Perhaps so. In a contract case,
well,
you don't care.
I mean, that's part of the allegations in the pleadings.
No, I think, Your Honor, you can't take the fact that they call it negligence.
You're saying the plaintiffs did not allege negligence?
I'm saying it doesn't matter whether the plaintiffs allege negligence. I'm saying that what matters is that under this court's legal theory, the plaintiffs can call it negligence. It is not negligence. The only claim that the plaintiffs have is a claim for breach of contract. The duties arise only in contract. The damages arise only in contract. Lamar Holmes did not have a negligence duty to construct this foundation. Lamar Holmes had a contractual duty to construct this foundation.
So whether the damages were caused negligently or intentionally, if it can constitute a breach of contract, then it's not covered. It's not an occurrence.
That's correct. If it is actually, certainly there, right? We understand that in the tort and contract arena, there are going to be close questions, and there are going to be things that can be both breaches of contract and torts. You've said that many times, but this court is very good at distinguishing when something is actually and only a breach of contract. And frankly, the lower courts are very good at it too. And the district court here, the federal district court, got that exactly right. These claims, if you can, perhaps someday there's something that you can allege that will be both a tort and a breach of contract. But in this case, and when this is the only type of allegation that you have, only construction deficiencies and only damaging the product itself, the house itself, in that situation, you have only a contract claim. That is what this court said in Jim Walter Holmes.
Well, why was the Fifth Circuit so concerned enough about it to send it to us if it was that clear?
I think that the
Fifth Circuit said that we haven't decided this specific issue directly and that our courts of appeals are split on the issue.
That is certainly true, Your Honor. The courts of appeals are split. I think that the courts of appeals have largely followed Behan since that decision out of the Dallas court came down. I think it's faulty. They do exactly what you said you don't do in Griffin and in Callens, which is you don't accept the plaintiff's pleading of negligence or a negligence theory or a negligence allegation as being determinative of what the claim actually is. And that's all we say ought to happen here. You ought to look at these allegations in exactly the same way. If you look at these allegations and you consider the law that distinguishes between torts and contracts in exactly the same way the law distinguishes between negligence and intentional torts, then you're going to come out in this case exactly the way we've said. Lamar wants you to change the definition of the word of accident that this court has used all along so that all you ask is, was the damage intended? Was it actually expected subjectively from the standpoint of the insurer? That is not this court's definition of an accident. This court says that if it is the natural and probable result And let me just stop there and talk about what the natural and probable result is of windows that are installed backwards, or a foundation that has not enough steel in it, which is the allegation here. The natural and probable result is going to be cracks in the sheet wall, water intrusion. If that's supposed to be the accident, it's not an accident, because those are absolutely the natural and probable, foreseeable as a matter of law, results of the conduct and of the physical structure itself when it is put in backwards or put in wrongly.
Seems though, counsel, if that's the test, then someone who doesn't pay attention at an unmarked intersection and drives through and hits somebody, we don't have an accident, because that's, I mean, anybody can tell you. That's why you look both ways. If you don't, you might have an accident. So if the test is you do something intentionally and something happens that you don't anticipate, it's still not an accident, don't we rule out that kind?
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think that the courts are actually very good at it. And as I say, the trial court did it here.
Let's say they intended to put in the right amount of steel and they designed it wrong. They did it just like it was a design, so we can say that's not an unexpected, unintended occurrence when the foundation falls.
Your Honor, when you have a contract, I mean, I think that you have to be able to distinguish.
Let me go to your contract just a second. I want to divert you, and I don't want to, because I look under your work in the definitions in this contract of insurance, and it says your work means. And it says your work includes warranty, and I'm reading on page 13 of 13. Your work includes warranties or representations made at any time with respect to the fitness, quality, durability, performance, or use of your work. So it seems like at some point there was a contemplation in here that there was more to it than simply a contract as opposed to a tort situation.
Your Honor, I think that what you have here, as I say, I don't think we read anything out of the policy. The defective, the work, absolutely includes the representations and the warranties and the product itself. But the question before the court is whether there is a property damage caused by an occurrence, which is defined as an accident. And there can be.
Well, let me ask you this. Say someone's on the second floor of that house where we have the design improper and the wrong amount of, through negligence. They just improperly calculated. Somebody ran their computer wrong one day. And someone's on the second floor of that house and 2 years later gives way and collapses. Is that an accident?
Bodily injury is always going to be
an
accident.
No, the occurrence. Not the results of the occurrence, but the occurrence itself.
You can only judge an occurrence, frankly, Your Honor, under this court's tests, by the results. That is what determines whether something is an accident or accidental.
Okay, so someone in the house who doesn't expect to get hurt and the house collapses, they have an accidental injury.
That's correct.
How about the house itself? And how about the house itself? Is the collapse an accident?
No. It's not, because you have to look at who the insured is. You've always said you look at it from the standpoint of the insured. The insured's only obligation to build a house that won't injure itself, collapse on itself, and not damage another thing. If that's all that happens, then that happens only because of a contractual obligation that exists. That's the only possible source of a duty that would ever give rise to liability. If the insured is someone different, then you're going to have different results. But there is nothing wrong with making the contractor responsible for his own performance.
So to put it another way, if a builder spent $1 million on what should be a $100,000 house to reinforce all the structures and the foundation with steel, metal, reinforcement agents that go well beyond what any builder would do, they said they're done. You're the owner, they give you the key to the house, you walk through the front door and it falls down, that's not an accident, still.
Your Honor.
Because it was built pursuant to a contract.
That would be correct, Your Honor. What could his possible liability be for that structure?
I'm just trying to understand conceptually where you're coming from.
And that is where I'm coming from. If the damage, we say in the law that damage to the subject matter of the contract is foreseeable as a matter of law. And once the damage is when you have only what this court has determined to be only a breach of contract, then the damage that arises from that comes entirely, it is entirely foreseeable. There is no other claim. This court said in Jim Walters Homes, you can't proceed on a negligence claim. However shoddily he's done or however well the builder has done, you don't have a negligence claim. You don't have a tort claim to bring. You have only a breach of contract claim.
Does that position run into our rule that determine duty to defend based on the pleadings? Plaintiffs pled negligence, breach of contract, and breach of warranty. They pled negligence. A minute ago, you said we should disregard negligence in this case, in their pleadings, and look at what's really at stake. So, I mean, do you need to reconcile those two positions?
Your Honor, I think you reconcile those two positions. It's the court's opinions in Cowan and in Griffin that say that that's how you interpret the, under the eight corners rule. That's not something new that I've come up with. That is what this court said. There were negligence allegations in both of those cases, and this court said the label that's attached of negligence does not count.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Hogan.
Justice Wehrman, I think your question hit it right perfectly. Mid-Con had said during its argument that if windows are put installed backwards, the reasonably foreseeable effect of that is that they're going to leak and cause damage. Yet Mid-Con, consistent with its own briefing, will defend and indemnify the framing subcontractor that put in the windows. They won't defend and indemnify the general contractor. The only difference is because the general contractor had a contract. That puts too much emphasis on the label of the cause of action. They give credence in their brief to the duty to defend standards, but then they ignore it. On the one hand, they say you can ignore negligence-based allegations by applying a liability defense in the duty to defend standard, which has problems in of itself, applying a liability defense in the duty to defend. But after we apply our liability defense in the coverage court, the economic loss rule, and all that's left is breach of contract, breach of warranty, well, those causes of action per se are not covered by the CGL policy. But yet, if you look at the handout on property damage and occurrence, you don't see any mention whatsoever of that distinction. And the California Supreme Court in the landmark Vandenberg decision noted that the arbitrary distinction between contract and tort is evident when we consider that the same act may constitute a breach of contract and a tort.
In the example with lawyers, of course, lawyers, we make you buy two policies, CGL policy and a professional liability.
That's true.
How come we don't make home builders do the same? You're saying, obviously, you would have professional mistakes a home builder makes and CGL-type mistakes. But CGL insurers that make the mistake of insuring home building companies get to pay all of them. If you represent lawyers, you don't.
Well, I mean, there are different types of policies that are sometimes at issue. The engineers.
But CGL policies are, your CGL policy is probably not that much different from Lamar Home.
That is absolutely correct. They're standard. They're standard.
So how come they have to pay for all the negligent mistakes that home builders make, but not lawyers?
They have to pay for the negligent mistakes that cause property damage. And that's really the difference. I mean, you're still governed by the insuring agreement. It's just like I think you said, it's difficult to get hurt in this job. It's difficult for me as a lawyer to cause property damage or bodily injury. So you're still governed by that insuring agreement. And Lamar recognizes.
And let me try to understand.
Sure.
You think if you use paint that fades over time and it shouldn't have faded, that is an injury or that's
not? That is not, because that's not physical injury.
Or glass that's tinted and that gets to where it doesn't tint anymore, that's?
Only if that causes a loss of use to the house. That's another part, that's the second part of property damage, but in of itself, that probably would not be property damage. And again, we've got to realize that this policy is filled with exclusions that delineate the scope of coverage for construction defects.
I know you've already covered this, but now I'm getting lost here. Why isn't that property damage, the example that just a sec gave, is it because the extent of the damage isn't significant?
No, because what courts have said is physical injury means an actual physical change in the property. If you have the DCB case, which they cited out of the Colorado court, That was a media room that just wasn't soundproof enough. That's a customer dissatisfaction claim. That's a perfect example of where there's an allegation of a construction defect that would not trigger the insuring agreement. If you've got a media room that's just not soundproof enough, that's not physical injury of tangible property. If you've got a window that just delaminates a little bit or lets more sun through, that's not physical injury.
What if the damage is an antique couch?
That's your physical injury of tangible property. The exclusions. See that.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes all arguments for today. And the marshal will now adjourn.